this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is Arifa Akbar. Although putting pen to paper is her day job at The Guardian, she's their chief theatre critic, her first full-length book, Consumed, is a far cry from what she normally writes. It's a personal exploration of her own grief after her sister was taken seriously ill and died at the age of 45 from tuberculosis. In this moving debut, Arifa explores illness, sisterhood, grief, and art. Arifa, thank you so much for joining me. This was an incredibly painful book to read. Was it painful to write?
In parts, it was painful to write because I had to dig deep to write it. It wasn't my first instinct to put pen to paper when my sister died in 2016 at all, actually. And it might be an irony, given I'm a journalist and given I've been trained to think out things on paper. I think grief just left me fairly silenced, actually. It silenced me because I just couldn't articulate at first the horror and the shock of it, because my sister had died in such bizarre circumstances in a big leading research hospital in London, and she'd been shuttling in and out of it, and she hadn't had a diagnosis, and nobody knew what was eating away at her. And it was only after she'd had a fatal brain hemorrhage that she was actually, the following day she was diagnosed, when she was already dying. There was no coming back from the hemorrhage. Those circumstances left me so horrified. I thought, you know, this diagnosis of TB, how can it be in this day and age? Should she have died this way? Should she have been undiagnosed until too late? How could this happen? All of that, rather than leaving me, making journalistic inquiries or writing about it, left me just pretty horrified and thunderstruck and paralyzed in a way. And it was only when my sister, who was an artist, it was only when her tutor at her art college, which she'd returned to many decades after first taking up art, and the tutor suggested they have an art exhibition at Camberwell College, and I thought that was a great idea. But as part of that, the tutor wanted me to write a little essay to go in the catalogue that was accompanying the exhibition. And my heart sank because I thought, how am I going to do this? I couldn't even bring myself to write about my sister's artwork. And I pushed through it, and it hurt to write it. But actually, it left me feeling both close to my grief in a good and a bad way, in the sense that it was a terrible feeling, and yet it was cathartic. I felt there was something to explore in there too.
Mm. It's interesting that you talk about feeling silenced, because that's not the first time in your life that it happened to you. You were brought up initially in Pakistan, in Lahore, and then when you moved to London, you only spoke Urdu at that point, and you describe how it was difficult. You say, now words didn't emanate from the back of my throat, but from the shallows of my mouth, close to the lips, to make tepid sounds, none as satisfyingly guttural as Urdu. I'd always been very talkative, but my new world and new language left me silenced for a while. And I wonder if you could take us back there and just tell us about your early childhood and your sisterly bond, but also how your parents, particularly your father, engaged with your sister.
As a family, we shuttled between London and Lahore quite a bit in those early years of my life. My sister was born in Lahore after my parents had got an arranged marriage, both agreed to it and both met each other and liked the look of each other, got married. But there was a lot about my father that my mother's family and my mother didn't know. He was a lot older than my mother. He had been married before. I'm not sure if, you know, my mother really registered that. And she certainly didn't know that within him, he hadn't really left that marriage behind emotionally. So there was my mother at the age of 25, getting married to a man of almost 40, thinking, this is dreamy, I'm going to, you know, she knew that my father was based in London. She was very excited to be taken from Lahore to London, begin her new life. She became pregnant. And at that point, my father left to go back to London to sort of organise a place for them and a future for the family. So my sister was born without my father's presence. She was born in Lahore. And she stayed there for over a year with my mother and her family, you know, the maternal grandparents, having a really lovely little first year of her life. When she came to London, there was a disconnect between my father and my sister. And I think that that had fairly, you know, many complex reasons. One, my sister was scared of him. She didn't know who this stranger was. He was essentially a stranger to her. My father, meanwhile, I imagine he felt a lot of very complicated feelings because the daughter, his first daughter, bound him to a marriage that perhaps he felt very equivocal towards. So there was something, a disconnect that sort of solidified into perhaps a distrust or wariness of each other. And when I came along, I was born in London 2 years later. When I came along, my father just much more straightforwardly adored me, and I became the favorite. And it was a very clear division that I became the favorite, and my sister was in some ways cast out subtly. And, you know, it was a sort of emotional casting out, but there were, over the years, his behaviour was so different towards her, which I didn't quite register as a child. But as I grew up and grew closer to my sister, I heard about the differences and I saw them. I became aware of how different our fathering had been, actually. And, you know, we were taken back to Lahore when we were both little. My younger brother had been born also in Britain, and that all of us went back in hope to relocate in Lahore. And those years are incredibly vivid and filled with colour and filled with family and filled with love for me. Looking back now, I see the family dynamic and I see how it would have perhaps impacted on my sister very differently, because I do think there was, within the extended family, a lot of very complicated feelings towards my mother that then extended to my sister and didn't extend to either my brother or myself. So those complications, that dynamic, essentially left my sister more of an outsider, and it affected our sisterhood because, of course, the way the family treated the two of us in very different ways impacted on the way that we regarded each other, our positioning in the family. And all of that came to bear down on us, even though we're very, very close as teenagers and we were best friends and confidants. It came to bear down on us in my 20s and 30s, when her depression and eating disorder took hold, and also when her immense anger and sense of injustice took hold, that this had happened to her as the only child that this had happened to. Why had it happened to her? Why had she been cast out as a baby? Why had she been treated differently as one sister and the other sister had been held close and she'd been sort of kept at arm's length, but also, you know, slightly emotionally abused in some ways, you could call it that. Mm. So all of that became part of who we were as sisters.
And, I mean, she struggled with her mental health all of her life. It's clear, obviously, her early treatment must have had a huge bearing on that.
I think it did. And she couldn't see a way around it. And the depression was immense, and so was the eating disorder. And it did affect us as sisters. And I think the dark side of sisterhood, is, I say this in the book, isn't always talked about. The edgier, you know, sides of jealousy, envy, hurt, you know, a sense of rejection. All of those things came down to bear on us, and it was mixed in with her, you know, paralyzing eating disorder and depression that she's tried so hard to overcome. You know, after her A-level, she at the age of 18, got into St. Martin's, the art school. It was a prestigious art school, and she was very talented, and it was clear she was a talented artist. And her depression sort of began taking grip then, and she dropped out to do nothing, and she could do nothing. It sort of left her paralyzed, not just as a teenager, but for decades. It sort of ate up her life. And it was only in her early 40s that she returned to the thing she loved, which was art. And she returned to the art because of a sewing class that my mother suggested to her at the local Asian Women's Center. My mother was so worried for my sister because she saw how deep she was in the pit of depression. We couldn't think of a way to get her out. And my mother remembered when she first came to London, she'd been depressed and isolated. And what had helped her was sewing and embroidery. And so my mother suggested this to my sister, who was, she was in her late 30s. And my sister, out of desperation, I think, went along to this class that was filled with late middle-aged South Asian women speaking in Urdu and Hindi and Gujarati. And my sister sat there quietly in a corner and began learning to embroider. Mm. And in the course of that, her love and passion for art flared up again.
Now, one thing about the book, I mean, you talk about her eating disorder. You're very, very honest about yourself. And you say that you too got into binge eating and how in your 40s, after her death, that urge to fill yourself up was back. You say, I was not only eating, but being eaten. And I feared this monstrous compulsion would finally drag me down and destroy me as it had done Fawzia. Which is just such a brutally honest piece of writing.
Speaking about eating disorders has become much more permissible. We've heard, you know, we've seen testimonies, accounts of anorexia and bulimia. I feel as if binge eating and compulsive eating disorders are, you know, the thing that many of us still don't talk about. It's somehow seen, I think, by some as unfeminine. You know, it's still got certain taboos around it. And my sister, you know, had an enormous eating disorder that encompassed all of those disorders that I've mentioned, anorexia, bulimia, compulsive binge eating disorder. And, you know, I shared some of those disorders in a far smaller way compared to hers. But I've had that throughout my life. You know, I've had a really problematic and complicated relationship with food. And I think many men and women do. And we don't always think it's okay to talk about it. I've talked about it with other women, actually, but they've been very surreptitious about it and actually quite ashamed. And my sister was never ashamed, neither of her depression nor of her eating disorder, which is something I greatly admired about her. She shouted it out to the world. It wasn't a version of shame where she was eating surreptitiously. She was loud and disruptive and wanted the world to know that she was hurting. And I think I've never hidden, you know, my compulsive eating, but I have seen the shocked responses of friends and people around me to it. And sometimes I've done it in private to protect them. And also I've got sick of explaining myself. But I did want to write about it. And, you know, it's not a large part of the book, but it's there because it's there in my life. And, you know, it is one of these things. Food is a difficult thing and a difficult addiction and a difficult compulsion, because unlike, you know, drugs and alcohol, you need food to live. You know, it's a necessary sustenance. When it's also a compulsive thing and it's an addiction, how do you navigate that? How do you, you have to eat to stay alive, but you're confronted by the thing that's also your compulsion, you know, three times a day or more. So it's one of those things that I felt I wanted to write about because I didn't want it to be tucked away and seen as secret and shameful, which I think compulsive binge eating disorder to some degree still is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, the book has a whole other strand to it, a sort of artistic strand. As you say, she was diagnosed with TB, but really before, I mean, too late to do anything, and something that could have been solved by antibiotics, which is the tragedy, isn't it? But TB, of course, has this sort of romantic history. You've got opera, La Traviata, for instance, you've got Keats dying of TB, and that's something that you explore in some depth. Tell us about that relationship with art.
Yeah, so this was the part of the book that was the great, for me, it had all the elements of discovery. Perhaps I was really naive in 2016 in thinking that we had completely defeated TB, that TB was a disease of the past with, as you say, all this enormous mythology. And this wrote very romantic mythology in the sense that in the 18th and 19th century, it was both seen as this, in the West, both as a grimy disease of back streets and working class life and impoverished life, but also, paradoxically, it was elevated and the TB look, the aesthetic, was emulated by the upper classes. You know, the pale, frail, jutting clavicle look was something that people put makeup on and, you know, aimed to sort of capture that look. So there was all this mythology there that I knew about, but I didn't know about the reality of TB in our world today. And the reality is this, you know, I went on an enormous mission, to medical mission in a sense, first of all, because I was thunderstruck by the fact that this large team of incredibly experienced doctors had missed this ancient disease that, as you say, could have been cured by antibiotics. How had this happened? How was it that the disease I thought had left the world was back in London and undetected? So that led me on to sort of the first part of it was the medical side of it. Apparently it hasn't, well, I found out in 2016, it hasn't gone away at all. In fact, in those years and before, it made a very big comeback in the West. It's always been there in the non-Western world, but in the West, it sort of made a comeback, and particularly in Britain, particularly in London, with enormous rates of TB, higher rates in some cases than in some countries in the African continent, and so equivalent to the subcontinent. And I was very shocked finding that out. I dug deeper and read reports in The Lancet and realized that this was a disease that TB experts classed as a pandemic, as a live pandemic in the 21st century. Mm. And yet this is a pandemic that in Britain, certainly, and in Europe, we've pushed out of our line of vision. And because it's not here, or we think it's not here in the same numbers, we think we vanquished it. Well, we haven't. You know, it's still the biggest, well, I don't know what compared to COVID results of late, but the biggest infectious diseases killer in the world. The thing with TB is it can be a simple matter of being cured with antibiotics, and it also can be, depending on how it manifests in your body, difficult to detect, as was the case with my sister. When TB disseminates from your lungs into other organs, it becomes very tricksy. And it's an incredibly slippery disease. And that's what makes it deadly, because it can be very hard to diagnose, even in the West. So I went on that trail. And the other trail I went on was to investigate this enormous mythology around it. As you say, I went to Keats' house in Hampstead, and I realized the uncanny proximity that, you know, Keats suffering TB in the 19th century in one spot in Hampstead was actually a 10-minute walk away from the home we had squatted in when we came from Lahore to London, and we were homeless, and we lived in this, quite invisibly, we lived in this, in the midst of wealth, being utterly impoverished in this terrible, dilapidated building that we were squatting in, which was, you know, this a few stone throws from Keats' house. So I went to Keats' house. I went also to Rome to see the little room in which Keats died. His friends collected enough money to send him to Rome in hope, in desperate hope, that the climate could save him, the drier, warmer climate in Rome could save him from his TB. They knew, you know, this TB was advanced. His own brother had died of it. His family, it was in the family. It was everywhere in London. They sent him to Rome. Keats desperately wanted and needed to live, to write, you know, so much of the poetry that was inside him. His diaries is testament to how desperately he was trying to bargain with God to live. And I went to this little room and I thought of my sister, and, you know, I took another journey to Norway, because I wanted to look at a painting that Edvard Munch had painted of his little sister, Sophie, who had also died of TB in childhood, actually. And that had marked Munch in so profoundly that he repeatedly painted her in various states of severe illness or close to death. Mm. And I looked into that too. And as you mentioned, you know, the opera, I went to Tuscany to see La Bohème because another uncanny thing, there are lots of uncanny things in the book, but at the age of 18, I'd forgotten this until after she'd died, but actually at the age of 18, I'd given my sister a pair of opera tickets to the Royal Opera House to go and see La Bohème. Why had I done that? I'm not sure, but she went and she came back thrilled, exhilarated, and only after she died, when I began my sort of artistic exploration of TB, I realised that actually, because I'd always stayed away from opera, but now looking at La Bohème and La Traviata, and then La Traviata, I realised these were operas that greatly romanticised TB and that had always had a sort of doomed, beautiful, tubercular woman who was doomed to die, you know, at the end of the opera. And I thought of my sister watching this at the age of 18. And there was a terrible sense of foreshadowing there. Mm. And so I went to Tuscany and I wanted to see this opera in the hometown of Puccini, you know, where he wrote it, and I did. So those were journeys of discoveries that both showed me the mythologies and, you know, around TB, but also revealed parts of my sister and parts of our sister relationship. And those were exciting for me. And I think I began to see my sister and I began to see us in a different light.
And the book actually has copies of her amazing art in it. And really what I suppose gives me heart after such a traumatic read, and it is, and that shouldn't put readers off. It's beautifully, beautifully written. But you talk about the arts feel very much a part of the business of making sense of the world. And you say that actually they soothe you. The paintings and the plays help you to understand her death.
Absolutely. It really, yes. So I think the art, the various art that I saw and read were both a way to understand grief and a way to understand sisters and families and to soothe as well. And to be reminded of the fact that my sister and I really bonded in our teen years over art, not just visual art, although that was her big, great love, but books and films and theatre and television. And it's consuming all of those things was a way to understand ourselves and a way to understand the world. It really was. And I've kept that, you know, that's something inheritance, you know, from my sister, really, because she's the one who I followed. Her love of the arts is something that I followed, and it became my working life. And I've always thought of the arts as not a sort of bauble or something you do after work or in your extra hours to unwind and to soothe yourself and to comfort yourself. It's actually encompasses, you know, this essential business of how we live, how we are in the world. The arts is life in a way, you know, it explores everything from grief to love to loss to being a lover or a sister or a father. It does all of those things. So, of course, you know, I did turn to the arts when she died, and the arts showed me so much about life and love and loss. And then there was, of course, as you say, her art, and her portfolio was immense. She must have been in a fury of creation, you know, in the last few years of her life, because when she died, her art emerged from every corner of her little flat. It was enormous. It sort of seemed to grow in the light of her death. And it took me a few years to actually really open up that immense portfolio and look at it and look at her through these really very joyous and colourful and, you know, sparkly embroideries and beautiful oil and pastel work. And I saw parts of her that I hadn't seen, that I was blind to, that I'd misjudged. And again, that's a reminder of what art contains, you know, what a lot of the world and of us the arts contain for us. It's all there for us to see and make sense of.
Arifa, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you.
Consumed, A Sister's Story by Arifa Akbar, is published by Scepter. And you've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to my producer, Nora Hull, and researcher, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.